This is the First Time Podcast.
Part reality series.
Part writer's masterclass. It's a podcast about the first time
you publish a book.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collett. Welcome to The First Time.
Dear Catherine, how are you?
I'm good. I just got a message from you on my phone.
Well, I figured we couldn't go into the studio like we normally would to have such exciting news.
Yeah, so not only a message but a photo, and it says reading copies arrived. And there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 copies of The Mother Fault.
There are 5 copies. I mean, there's already a hot bidding auction among my dear families and friends for who gets their hands on these 5 copies.
Of course.
But it was really exciting.
Funnily enough, I reckon this time round, I would be so much, when the helpline arrived, I was like, oh, I can't even look at it. Don't even want to open the box. This time I'd be much more straightforward, excited. Is that how you're feeling?
Yes, I was straightforward, excited. There's a little bit of weirdness about it because I suppose it's still so far away. These are the reading copies. So it's not the final cover, but still it's the real life thing. And I'd seen like pictures of it, but the real life thing, which you can hold in your hands and you can flick through, and every page is filled with words that you wrote and labored over, is pretty exciting.
Amazing.
Of course, I did try and do a practice unboxing with my daughter's going. Now, there's a few issues right now because obviously, all being at home as we are, failing to shower and get dressed as we kind of are, you know, it wasn't great. The lighting wasn't great. I didn't look my best, but there are some pointers there. Etta also opened the packet. It was one of those, you know, recycled cardboard ones so that the inside then just completely fell out, which she thought was like confetti, but which was actually just gross recycled paper everywhere. So, you know, some good pointers for how I will do the well-lit, well-made-up unboxing.
Yeah, I feel like lighting will make a big difference for you.
Yeah. And we're going to talk about this today. We're talking about online, how authors are doing it right at this moment. But first, highlights and lowlights of your week in isolation. How have you gone this week?
I feel like I'm on the cusp of turning a corner, I reckon. It's been hard. I think it's been so uncertain. And the lack of certainty, whereas now I feel like I'm just resigned to the fact that this is life for the next 6 months. And that has kind of made it easier, and we've started to get a bit of a routine. Our kids had been really hard to get to bed. They're now a bit easier to get to bed. That makes a massive difference.
Because of the routine?
Because I just think that they were worried, probably, you know, and sort of – and it's that when you're acting out at night, everyone's over it, you're sort of – like that's when it starts to feel hard. But – that sort of going well makes a massive difference. Paid work is bloody hard from home. I tell you what, oh my God. Like, it's good that I can keep working, but I mean, we're doing things like virtual site visits and, but I mean, we're doing sweet things with work. Like, we have a end of the week, like a fancy dress, knockoff drinks kind of thing. Yeah, excellent. Which is good. And you get to see people's backgrounds and people's houses and look at their kids and bits and pieces. Like, that stuff's all really cool. Highlights and lowlights for you?
The day that I first started taking notes, I was like, you know, this is shit. Like, I can't do it. I don't know how anyone's doing it. I'm resentful of my partner. I'm resentful of anyone who can still get their kids to childcare. I can't possibly do this. And then a couple of nights ago, I just cracked up when we went to bed. I was like, this is ideal, really, isn't it? If you've a bit of space like we have, and if you've got a bit of financial security, which we are lucky enough to have because Adam's still got his job, you know, I'm reading, the kids are all right, everyone's all right. This is, I'm going to lean into it. And I saw someone, I think it was Kate Foster actually on Twitter saying, you know, using the term radical acceptance. And I'm like, yeah, maybe that's what it is. Just stop fighting it, Mildenhall. Just lean into it a bit more. So
I totally get the day by day too. Like a really good day for me was I got a advance reader copy of Kate Grenville's new book, which I think you have you started that? Have you received it?
I haven't started it. Sitting right here on my desk next to me. I'm so excited.
So good. Like you're in for a treat. I think I read it in one day. It was great. Really good. Loved
Does this
it.
Mean that we have to go back to an virtual arm wrestle about who gets to interview
I
her?
Know,
because
I know. Maybe.
I was so excited. But, you know, if we have to arm wrestle over it, obviously we can. Obviously we can. You know the other thing that you told me to do, which I did yesterday, which has made me feel good, is I went and gave blood.
Ah, did you get the biscuit?
I got the biscuit. I got a sticker too because it was my first time, which was really exciting. And everyone was especially nice to me. But I think there's also that aspect of, you know, feeling useful and feeling like you can help. Is a way that
it's a feel good activity. Absolutely,
it is a feel good activity. And I think at the moment when helpers, and I know that you know I'm a bit of a helper, sometimes too much of a helper, can feel really at sea at the moment because they can't go out and do things that they would normally do, or you know do all the helping actions, and they can't fix it anything.
Boosted
my general emotional well-being yesterday. So I join your chorus of saying highly recommend. Also, Catherine, there were people out there.
Oh,
I got
my God.
To speak. Well, I'm human.
I know exactly what you mean. And they will even just quite intimately talk to someone when they're doing the blood stuff. Like,
it was so
very
hook me up again as soon as I can come.
I'll do plasma. You can do plasma more often.
I have been to some events. I went to the Avid Bookshop, the launch of Mirandi Rewo's new book, Stone Sky, Gold Mountain, and we're going to speak to her in a couple of episodes' time. It was so awesome.
Was it?
Because there were so many people. There was like 180 people or something.
That's awesome.
In the room. Like it wasn't the same, but of course I wouldn't have got to go to hometown launch if it hadn't been for this. And we're looking at the positives here. We know all the negatives, so let's just talk the positives. I need your help with an etiquette question. This actually happened to me I did Charlotte Wood's Zoom kind of
Q&A. Was that amazing? I had to work that day. Was it really good?
It was so great. I mean, really, I feel like Cheryl Strayed, Liz Gilbert and Charlotte, they could just get me through the entire pandemic, I think, just their wisdom. But so 100 people in the session and, you know, you can see everyone and whatever in their names. Now, I fangirled because there was another writer in that session. There were lots of amazing writers, but there was one writer in particular, Emily Perkins, who is interviewed in Charlotte's book. She wrote The Forests, and I just love her interview. I reread it over and over again. I loved her book, and I couldn't help myself. So I was like, oh, my God, Emily Perkins, you're in this room.
Oh, my God, you're networking at an online event.
I was doing it in the chat because obviously we were all muted. So what I want to know is what is the etiquette? Because we normally wouldn't be in these situations where we can see so intimately people in there. Potentially they're in the pyjamas. I mean, they've made that choice. And their names are there. You wouldn't normally have such.
Yeah, that's so interesting. So it's like
access to these people.
Alternate layer of intimacy within something that is on the surface far less intimate.
Yeah, it's weird. So anyway, if anyone has any suggestions about what they've found, what's appropriate, what's not appropriate, am I allowed to fangirl at people in the side chat? Just let me know because I'm anticipating getting to a lot more of these events. I went to Shannon Malloy's Facebook launch as well. So that I've done a couple of Facebook launches too. So that's a different kind of feel to the Zoom one because you're just chatting. It would be interesting to speak to authors and we will be asking this question of the authors we interview if they're in that position about what it feels like to do that, to be kind of launching where you can't see necessarily what's coming back at you.
Yeah. I wonder they might end up in 12 months' time, maybe we'll end up doing both. You'll do, not an online launch, but maybe we'll broadcast launches more than, because who did that before, really?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's a few things. Tell me, do you watch many videos online? Are there tips that you have? Is there something you particularly like when you're looking at them? Have you ever made one?
No, I've never made one aside from the one that I made with text as like a an author type thing. Is that what you mean? Like
Yeah.
Which my tip was don't do anything I did.
Why?
Brush what your hair. I think I just remember I think you have to be prepared as well for that opening still will always have you with a really weird expression on your face.
Yes.
I don't know how that is so inevitable. We must spend 90% of our 90% of the movement of our face must be really, really awkward because cameras never seem to catch you at a nice moment.
No, that's so true. Okay, that's a good point. I must admit when I've been trying to take shots for social media of people's launches online, I have gone through to make sure that I get a nice smiling face. And I encourage listeners, please do the same. Please pay other people that respect. I want to point out two people who I think are making good quality ones. And please let us know who other listeners who you've seen. Natasha Lester's new book has come out recently, and I think she is a pro at making.
She's an absolute pro. Why does everything she does seem so effortless and
I know.
Beautiful.
So maybe we need to get her on and ask her how she does it. She looks great. Like she's obviously, she's not going to go, wow, I should have taken my hair out of the ponytail. She looks great for all of them. She's got the nice setup in the back. Obviously, the key thing is to put lots of copies of your book behind you.
Yes.
This is important. The lighting is obviously very important. And I don't know if she does practice runs. I want to find that out because, yes, I know that the word coming to me from my publisher for a release later in the year is that I'm going to be making a bunch of videos. So I need this information.
Yeah, you do. But they will help you, do you think? Or I suppose it depends what the world looks like.
I hope so. I've asked in advance, like, if you find good ones, people, let me know who's doing it really well. I do like Ben Hobson's new YouTube series. I don't know if it's a series. I don't know if I've seen the next one. The first one I watched was Stuff Writing Is Like, and it's Writing Is Like Smoking Pork Ribs.
I didn't see, that's a relatively new one, isn't it?
Yeah,
I've seen some of the early ones, I think.
Yeah.
They are very good.
Yeah.
That's something we will definitely link to.
Yeah, we'll link to that. That's, I'm quite enjoying that. And then there's, of course, all of the authors who are reading their books online, particularly picture book authors. I did watch Alison Lester doing Kissed by the Moon the other day because it's my most favourite picture book ever, and that was pretty lovely. Although I suppose there's that issue of, your content and
I don't know how they've navigated that.
No, I don't know either.
There's some sort of moratorium or I don't know.
Yeah. So that's, there's some other ones. I also, one more, Liz Gilbert, I've talked about her a lot, but obviously the paperback version of her City of Girls is coming out at the moment and she can't go on tour. So she's got Broadway actors.
Oh my
reading
God.
Parts of the book because it's kind of got this theatre, 1920s theatre feel.
Have you read that book?
I have.
It's really good, isn't it?
I loved it.
Yeah, I really loved it too. Her signature of all things, I've probably said that before, is really good as well.
Yeah, no, I haven't read
very,
that yet.
Her fiction is very, very different to her Eat, Pray, Love.
Yeah.
You sort of expect someone who wrote Eat, Pray, Love to be a bit more like a Marion Keyes.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Yeah, but her fiction... This Gilbert's fiction is quite deep.
Yeah, okay. I shall go back to that one. But, yeah, I love that. So I love the way that people are doing interesting little things like that.
So Foster Blake would be one to look at for video content. I watched her. No, I don't do any, cleansing, toning sort of stuff. But I watched her for 15 minutes go through her cleansing routine on Instagram. And God, it would have cost a fortune, but it was mesmerizing.
Yeah. She is mesmerizing. She's the master of it. Social media pals tell me that all the time. I wanted to shout out to a couple of other things that I think people would gain a lot from. Cheryl Strayed has just started a new podcast, Sugar Calling. Were you a Dear Sugar fan?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Through you sent me one that was amazing, that Write Like a Motherfucker.
Yeah.
Get down on the ground. We will link to that in show notes as well.
She's so amazing. And the first episode of this, so Sugar Calling, it's Cheryl Strayed talking to writers, I think over the age of 50 or over the age of 60, I think she said, about this moment. So it's very timely. And her first one is with George Saunders. And oh my goodness, it's so good.
Ooh, I'm downloading it right now.
So damn good. Get on it. It's really, really impressive. So that will be one that I will be listening to immediately it comes out for the next couple of weeks. And then some Oz author things, Oz Authors Online. Check out their website. I think maybe we mentioned them last week, but they're doing online launches. Together Remotely, which Cara Llewellyn, I think I've got her name right, is doing, which is conversations with writers, and then you buy their book as well. And she's got you read Less, didn't you? You loved Less.
Oh, I read it and I
didn't love it. She has that.
I wanted to love it though, if that counts.
No, it totally counts. So some of these things, I think Bram Presser and JP Pomare are running a book club, Sonia Orchard's that running would a book be club. A
lot of fun.
Yeah, just have a look. There's so much stuff. We'll link to these ones, but there's so much stuff. The Garrett's doing Authors at Home. Read Tasmania is doing lockdown reading group where writers read from their novels on YouTube on a particular night a week. I can't remember which one, but we'll link to that. So there's heaps of amazing stuff to look at if you can't afford to go out and buy all the books.
But on the topic of books, I'm reading now because we all have a to-be-read pile.
Yeah.
And so now I'm looking at my to-be-read pile. I mean, you're always sort of looking at it in a way like, oh, we'll get to that. But now I'm sort of getting to some of the books that had been stayers, you know, because it'd been there for a while. And that is good.
Okay.
The other one, which is more available to people that have ebooks, is accessing the books. Sometimes I don't know if I should be suggesting things, but accessing the books that are out of copyright online. So I downloaded Alice in Wonderland, which I'd never read. Boring. So boring. I don't know why it's inspired so much creativity.
Did you read it with kids or were you reading it on your own?
I was reading it on my own. I don't know why I picked that, but, you know, you just search for random things. But the other one, which is really good, I don't know if you've ever read it, is Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People. Have you ever read that?
No, I have
not. It's really good. It's like the very first self-help book, I think it's kind of hailed as. But and it's dated in some ways, but it's a well worth reading. And the other thing I'm doing is because we don't have a lot of space is sending the books I've read to other people.
Yeah, nice.
Which is good, is a nice feeling.
Very important.
I get to go to the post office.
Yeah, I was going to say, are you posting them or are you doing like drop-offs in driveways?
I've just been posting. Now that you say that, that seems like a very obvious, much cheaper option.
Well, only because the post is, let's face it, but it is taking a little while longer than usual at the moment. So, yeah, I'm considering doing some just getting out of the house. Although, I don't know, will you get picked up? Is that considered an essential service?
Just don't put your L plates up. The other thing I'm torturing myself with is looking at she sheds and writing studios. Oh, my God.
Mate, I can highly recommend. I've now got this thing going in the morning. So alarm's going off quite early. I make my coffee inside, then I open the door and I walk out and I open the door of my studio and it is just blissful. And it's already, you know how I've talked about that shortcut that we get when we go to Musk that is like, I know, you know, the body remembers that it's here, right? That's what it's already building. And it's
so like, is that detached from the house? Is yours actually a separate?
Yeah. I mean, not very far away, but it is.
Oh.
Do it. Just, I promise you will not regret it.
Just imagining the bookshelf too is like,
things to do, because I know that we always like to have things to do when we're a bit at a loss. Extraordinary Routines. Madeline Dorr has got a survey up at the moment on the Extraordinary Routines page about how you're navigating the pandemic. And so that's something that people could jump onto and do if they're interested. Also, the Bridging the Distance project by the National Museum, they're collecting people's experiences now, you know, for the future, for people who are looking back at 100 years and saying, how did everyone cope with
COVID? That's great. Time capsule.
So it's on Facebook. We'll put the link in and you just join the group. And then already there's like people whose, you know, weddings were cancelled and they've got a wedding photo of just them with their masks on and kids reading to camera. So they're collecting all kinds of things, video, photographs, whatever you want to
put. That's great.
Yeah. So it might be something you do with the kids or on your own, but all good reasons for people to be recording what's happening for them now, even if it is I can't possibly write and there is still no bread flour. I mean, these things are important. Sarah Bailey is a Melbourne-based writer with a background in advertising and communications. She has two young children and currently works at VMLY and R Melbourne. Her first novel, the best-selling The Dark Lake, was published by Allen & Unwin in 2017, followed by Into the Night, Where the Dead Go, is her third novel in the Gemma Woodstock series. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you for having me.
I must say this is a whole new thing for us. We're doing this via Skype, which is new. I very much like to have people in the studio where I can be up in their face and make them spill all their secrets. So I'm going to try and make you spill your secrets this way instead. Sarah, sure. Tell me about the first time you ever saw yourself in print.
Well, it was actually in the Herald Sun in about 2002 because I wrote a tiny little piece when I was there doing a one-week work experience gig. And it was all about why people should visit Ballarat. I think they had like a little sort of sideline weekly column that said, kind of like places that you should go and visit in Melbourne. It was about 200 words. My grandma cut it out and stuck it on her pin board. So, yeah, I think that was sort of officially the first time that I was published, I suppose.
Were you always writing at school and did you want to be a writer when you grew up?
No, I mean, I always really, really liked reading particularly, and then writing as well. I mean, I've always sort of been quite into creative writing, and I do remember kind of particularly choosing any creative writing options if there was ever a choice at school. So it was definitely something that I was really keen to do. And I know that when I started uni, I sort of had this idea of writing a book and did start scribbling down a couple of ideas and a few chapters of things. But I think it just wasn't the right time.
Do you still have those?
Yeah, I've still got some of them. I mean, the ones from like school, not so much. But yeah, the one I started in uni, I do still have, and it's pretty bad, I think. But I think it had some good kind of character pieces and practice sort of plot points in it. So, I mean, I still think that one of the hardest things about writing is just the keeping going and actually kind of pulling it all together and turning it into a book. So I don't find writing itself particularly difficult. I really enjoy all kinds of writing, but that project-based writing where you're trying to start something, sustain it, and then finish it is really hard. And that's sort of, I guess, something that I don't think I was ready to tackle until I was a bit older.
Tell us the story of how The Dark Lake made it from concept to published book. Where did it begin? Were you a slush pile person? Did you do a speed dating with a publisher? How did it happen for you?
Okay, so it actually happened sort of by accident, because I had actually embarked on a different writing project, a book that I'd started and I'd really invested a huge amount of time in. I've written about 30,000 words of this book and I was quite serious about getting it written. And then I got really stuck and I kind of hit a brick wall on that idea. And then that's sort of around the same time that I just started having this other idea, which turned into The Dark Lake. And I was really reluctant to start The Dark Lake because I kind of thought, you know, I've read all the blogs, I've listened to all the podcasts, like you've got to keep at it. You've got to keep going with whatever it is that you've started. But the more that it kind of went on, I think I just realized that The Dark Lake was the book that needed to be written at that time. So I kind of switched, started The Dark Lake and made myself a promise that I would finish it, or I would go back and I'd finish the other one, so that I wasn't going to end up with like 15 started manuscripts that never went anywhere. So I started The Dark Lake, and it was the first time I think in my writing experience where I did just keep going, and I kind of managed to get to the middle and then the end, and then I edited it and it felt like a real finished story. I had no contacts in publishing or anything like that. I didn't really know sort of what to do with it, but I did start throwing myself into the writing world a little bit. So I did go to sort of some Sisters in Crime panels, and I went to some writing festival panels, and just tried to immerse myself in that world a little bit, which I found really helpful. I think just even from a sort of psychological point of view, being around other people that were in the same boat as me. I then started Googling agents and found the sort of agent list, and I sent off an email and a pitch to the first one on the list, which was Alphabetical Order. They also took my type of genre, which was shaping up to be, you know, crime thriller. And so I sent, I followed the instructions really carefully because everyone said that was, you know, really important. So I wrote the pitch email, attached the first 50 pages of the book, made sure that I sort of did everything that they'd asked and didn't really expect to hear back. And then Lynn, my agent, called and sort of said, look, I really like this. Send me the rest of it. If I like the rest of it, I'll sign you on. And so I obviously madly gave it another quick edit, send it all through. She did like it, which was obviously very lucky. And then I signed up with her and then went through a bit of an editing process with her, which was quite hard. I found that really hard.
Was that over 6 months? Was that over a year?
It was almost exactly a year. So I think I started it in April and then I finished the draft in sort of March. I pitched it to Lynn in March. She signed me up in March and then she and I worked on it sort of together, you know, for a couple of months. And then she started pitching it out, I believe, in June. And then by August that year, we signed with Allen and Unwin for The Dark Lake. And then we sort of did some edits on that. Yeah, it was all quite, I mean, it didn't feel quick, obviously, at the time, because when you're waiting for news, it doesn't feel quick ever, but it does feel quick looking back. And then, so they ended up sort of having a final manuscript in the following March after I had initially pitched it to Lynn. So it was definitely exciting. And, I mean, I know I'm very fortunate to have that pace, I think, in that experience, because I'm not a very patient person. I don't like waiting for anything and I find having idle time like a bit of a problem. So I think it really suited me and it meant I just could keep moving. And then I did end up having the contract for a second book before Christmas of that same year. So I sort of had 11 months to then get that draft done. So that meant that there was another thing to kind of quickly switch onto and move with as well. So yeah, it was a pretty crazy year that year.
So I'm going to jump around a bit now because you've mentioned the 11 months to get a draft done. And this is something I'm a little bit obsessed with at the moment. people who've been listening to the podcast will know that I've said this year, I'm going to attempt to be more like Jane Harper, JP Pomare, and yourself, Sarah, and try and write a book, my next book, really quickly. How do you do it in 11 months? How did you're working as well, you're a parent. How do you fit the writing in to get that draft done in 11 months?
I think it's hard looking back. I mean, I've gotten a bit slower, I think. The book I'm working on now, it's going to be 2 years that I sort of spent writing that one. But I am working in a job that is a bit more demanding at this particular point in time. And I think I just needed a bit of a break as well. So I think it's going to work out better for me and for the book. But for the first three books, it just felt like quite a fast-paced story, which I think I sort of translated into quite fast-paced writing. I like to work quite quickly.
Okay.
I'm a very fast, quick kind of worker, I think, in everything that I do. I'd like to think I'm quite measured as well, but I think that in terms of the pace at which I work, it tends to be pretty quick. So I write the draft very fast. I can write. I have had days where I've locked myself away and written 10, 12,000 words in a day. However, the editing for me is brutal because when I say I have a draft, it's pretty rough and pretty rubbish. So I sort of sometimes feel like I sort of say things to people like I have a draft sort of finished and they go, oh my gosh, you know, that's great. That's almost done. And I know now that that is not the case. So my draft is probably still 25% of the work done, I would say. I move things around a lot. I jump all over the place. I really have to rework the structure and the story quite considerably to get it right. But I do enjoy getting that draft down so that I've then got something to play with. So yeah, my routine's terrible. So there's no tips there. Definitely it's a cross between The Amazing Race and Tetris for sure. And I think the thing that I've learned though is to not fight that. I think it's same with my other job as well. You can get really overwhelmed with being busy to the point where the busyness itself becomes a job to be done. And I think that the thing that I've really embraced over the last couple of years is not really worrying about work-life balance, but just doing work and then not doing work and doing something else and just fitting that in whenever I feel like I can. I think that the overwhelm really takes up a lot of mental energy. And so I find that now when I have an hour, I just go, great, I've got an hour. I'll spend that hour editing that chapter, writing that 100 words, doing whatever feels sort of feasible within that time frame. And I think that is half the battle. I feel like maybe, you know, when I was a little bit younger, I would sort of go, oh gosh, unless I've got a whole day to work on it, there's no point even opening my computer. Whereas now I just open my computer and, you know, if the phone rings because a client calls me and I'm interrupted by that, fine. But it's sort of just trying to keep everything moving, I think, is one of the most important things that means I can turn sort of nothing into something, I guess.
Sure. Sarah, do you have a whiteboard, some special strategy to help you get each day to the writing that you're doing?
I really wish that I did have a whiteboard. That would be a smart thing to do. But I don't really have a particular strategy. The only thing I've found myself doing recently when I've got smaller kind of moments of time available is to not finish a chapter when I'm writing the night before or sort of on the weekend. I try to sort of leave it mid-chapter or leave it just before I know what I'm going to write about. And that way, when I come back to it, I've still got that momentum that I was feeling when I was writing, so I can jump straight back into it, finish that thought, and then I've sort of, I guess, already on a roll then. So that works really well for me, and it's definitely something that I've started doing more lately. Yeah.
I was really fascinated by a Q&A that I saw I saw that you'd done, where you talked about being about a month into the writing of The Dark Lake and the whole kind of plot and all the machinations of it revealing itself to you. Can you tell us a bit about that moment and how it all came together?
Yes, I can still really, really clearly remember that moment. It was my ex's birthday and we're about to go out for drinks. Yeah. And we were sitting at home sort of getting ready, having a drink or something. And I just sort of suddenly, it was almost like dominoes in my head. It all just fell into place. And I think my brain had obviously been working around all of the different plot points for the previous 4 weeks, and I had the start. I was really happy with the start of it. I had the characters sort of starting to really form, and then it was as if my brain just sort of went, here, this is how it's all going to sort of pull together. I was like, oh, my gosh, I've just figured it all out. My book, I know what happens, which is
so
quite strange. Yeah, I mean, it's sort of funny because it's almost like, when people are reading crime books, there's obviously a moment where they have that too. But it is funny when you're writing a crime book because you actually have that moment as well. It's just that you have it, even though you're in charge of it, you actually still have to go through that same process of sort of like, aha, that makes sense and that's how it all works out and that's the revelation that I need to kind of get to. So it's a weird process. But I think if you write crime or really any fiction that has a narrative arc, you do have to go through that process of discovery yourself. It's very nice though when you do feel confident that it is actually all going to work out.
Yes, and I think, you know, I've been listening to so many more crime writers now talking about the way they write and they're, because I think it's so helpful, or it's been really helpful for me to learn more about plotting and making sure there's a really clear narrative arc and being able to navigate all those little kind of subplots and other things going on. So I'm always so obsessed with finding out, like, did you know who done it at the start, or did you work that out in the middle, or did you go back and do that in editing? So has your process changed as you've done each of the three books? Did you have that revelatory moment for each of them, or did it happen in a different way?
I think it happened in a slightly different way for the others. The first one really did feel like a moment of sort of, aha, it's all clear in my mind. And then I just wrote really hard and fast toward it, and it was almost as if I had to write quickly to make sure that nothing stopped working, really.
Yes.
So that was kind of really nice. The energy was pretty high. And also I'd never written a book like that, well, a book properly before. So I was fairly blissfully ignorant of feedback at that point. So it was probably quite a free writing process. But I think with the other two and the current one, it's more about having a really strong premise, making sure that that sort of has some strength testing done to it. Character's obviously really important. I think an ending of some vague kind is pretty important before you start writing. I'm not a very good planner. I would love to be a planner, but it just doesn't, I really feel like until I start writing, nothing really good gets written down. I can do lots of structural sort of skeletons, but they end up being, from my point of view, me just procrastinating. I just need to get stuck into it to have any real progress. So I don't bother even pretending to plan anymore. I just write, but I do figure it out as I go along. And for me, the best sort of fuel for getting that to happen is writing or reading. And it's sort of that process seems to get my brain to jump ahead of itself and to start figuring things out before I've even really consciously made the effort to do it. So there's definitely sort of little aha moments in the subsequent two novels, but not in that sort of amazing, like a full map in front of me like that first one was. So it's a bit different, I think.
Tell me, in terms of writing a series, and I think I've asked other writers this before when they've had a sequel, do you have any sense of a plan, or have you got notes in terms of, like, for instance, where your protagonist, Gemma Woodstock, you know, where she's headed or where she's been, or do you just keep all that stuff in your head?
It's pretty much in my head. I think I remember the key pieces. And when you're writing as well, I tend to find that, you know, with the third Gemma book, for example, I would write something and then I would often think, oh, I know there was a reference to that in the second book. So I just make a note to go back and check what that was to make sure that it's accurate if I reference something or someone's physical appearance or, you know, likes or dislikes or something like that. So even if I don't remember the detail, I generally remember that there is a reference to that somewhere in the series. I definitely didn't plan it. I mean, I didn't know there would be subsequent books when I wrote the first one. So there wasn't really the willingness from my point of view. I was just so focused on getting that book done. I didn't have any trajectory planned. So I think, you know, there's probably a couple of things about the first book I would actually change knowing now that there is two other books, but not anything that's, you know, particularly problematic. And then, it's just a more of a continuation of that character. So it is hard to sustain a series when the stakes are so high. You sort of feel like, gosh, how much can this one person endure? But I guess that's why detectives and police people are so popular in crime, because it's the only real way that someone would suspend their disbelief that that many bad things can happen to someone.
When I've seen you talk about her in videos, there's almost a look on your face when you say how she's described as complicated. And obviously things are pretty complicated for her. I wanted to ask about how readers respond to her and if they have a real sense of if they're protective of her.
I think it's a mix. So sometimes people say that they really love being in her head by reading the books and they really enjoy her sort of chaotic life and some of her slightly arrested development vibes in terms of maturity and things like that. Yep. And then other people seem to really reject her whole premise and they don't like the decisions that she makes or her behavior, and they find it so frustrating that they almost tune out of the whole book, which is, you know, totally fine. I think it's just, it's interesting to me because I've always come back to this notion of why you would have fiction with a character, particularly in first person, where you're really in their head, who isn't pretty sort of interesting and different. I just think that, you know, it is fiction. It's not real life. You're not expected to be friends with these people. You're reading about them. So I find it a bit baffling myself because I love reading fiction where people are wonderful, awful, everything in between, but always extremes. I think that, you know, if someone is going to be a little bit dull in fiction, it's almost exaggerated and then that's the intent. So everything does tend to be amplified in fiction, particularly, you know, characters. And I think that's great. But some people I think do really take a liking to her and feel a bit protective of her, which is really nice. But yeah, a lot of people really don't like her as well. So it's a mixed bag, I think.
How does she kind of sit in your day-to-day world? Like, I can't imagine being with a character, you know. Do you kind of note things away, oh, that'll be something for Gemma, or do you think about how she might respond to situations, or is your head really divided, this is normal life and Gemma's over there in my writing world?
I think it's pretty divided. I'm definitely not one of those people that gets too lost in my own story. It's sort of when I'm writing, I'm writing. When I'm not writing, I'm not really distracted by it.
Yeah.
I think it's occasionally if I'm doing something really low engagement, like a long drive or a walk or, I don't know, a shower or something, like sometimes that's when I'll sort of have plot points or character sort of ideas creep into my head. But I think because during the rest of the day I'm so on with work or whatever I'm doing, I think, unless I have downtime, I'm pretty distracted by that. So, I mean, and I think now that I am not writing a Gemma book anyway, there's another character I should be paying attention to. So, she's sort of parked. She's kind of been benched, I guess, for a while. So if she comes back, then maybe things will start to kind of creep in again. But for now, she's having a rest. And she deserves a rest too.
Absolutely. She's been working hard. Sarah, tell us, because I wasn't sure. I was like, oh, I wonder if Sarah will talk about this or not. In terms of your new project, how different is that from obviously Gemma's not in there, but are we talking different genre or is it still in crime? What are you talking?
No, it's still in crime. It's a journalist protagonist this time. So she is still a she, but she doesn't have as much access, which I'm finding really frustrating, actually. The police get to, you know, look stuff
be
up
everywhere.
And they're right there, whereas journalists have to get pretty lateral in their creativity when it comes to getting access to crime info. So, it's different. She is different, very different sort of like looking, at least in my mind, and different setup altogether. And it's not in the first person, which I think is also quite different. I don't feel nearly as sort of intimately connected to her in a way, because I guess it's not that I'm doing this. It's not that stream of consciousness sort of writing. So it is a bit removed, I think. But not
did
to
you
say,
make that? Did you make that a conscious decision before you started that you wanted to be a bit more removed, or did it just come about that way as you started to write?
It's changed a bit. I tried it in first person for the first few chapters and then I just didn't feel like that was quite working. And then there's alternate chapters in the book that are another character. So it sort of felt strange to flip back and forth from different kind of premises in that sense.
Yeah.
So, it's ended up, I think it works better in that more observational style. It's definitely still a story that's very much from her point of view though. So there is still, like, I think there's still that intimacy from that angle, but it's just a little bit removed. And I think she probably seems slightly less chaotic because of that. I think when you're in someone's thoughts, probably everyone would seem pretty crazy, I think.
Yeah.
Whereas I think if it's more observational, you're only witnessing what's happening, not as much necessarily what she's thinking, although, you know, you get that insight as well. But it is still crime. I think, one thing that's interesting about crime is that you always have to be creating a sense of doubt. That's almost what drives a crime book along. So there's a lot of characters in this book that I guess you're just not quite sure what their intentions are. There's sort of one key crime but a couple of layers to it. So, as always, it's a complete mess and it's really hard to pull it together. So hopefully.
What phase are you in now, Sarah? Like are you editing? Are you going back over? Like where are you at with the process?
Okay, so I am almost finished a full draft, and for me that means that I had a really, really terrible skeleton draft.
Yeah.
And then I went back and fixed the first half. So the first half is pretty good.
Yeah.
And now I'm just working through the back half of it and trying to get that to be in a pretty good place as well. And then it'll go through the process of being edited and hopefully turned into a book. So my agent's read the first half. She's happy, which is good. But, you know, there's other people that need to get happy as well. So we'll see. I still feel like I don't feel very close, even though I guess, you know, I've got 120,000 words sitting on my laptop. It doesn't feel quite close to being finished yet. So we'll see.
It's certainly a point at which you can have a drink and pat yourself on the back.
Oh, I have drinks all the time. Yeah.
We're fine.
Every milestone.
Is your agent your first reader?
Yeah, she is now. I think with The Dark Lake, I just wanted to show anybody that would read it, and I just needed validation, like,
all the time.
Literally, yeah, all the time from everybody. I went back to, you know, you want mum and dad to read it. You want everyone to tell you that it's not terrible. I think I've learnt now that that's also a bit of a procrastination tactic. So I try to just finish the book now before I show anybody. I did show my agent the first half of this one just because I wanted to make sure she knew I wasn't lying, that I was writing it and I was actually making progress. And I think she was quite keen to know that too. So that was worked for everybody. But yeah, I don't really bother showing it to anyone now because it just feels sort of like me having a pause when I don't really need to have a pause. I think my sister's read a couple of chapters of this one, the early version of it. She had some time and she was happy to read it. So that was kind of nice. But, you know, until it's a whole book, feedback's actually not really that useful because it's got to be the whole book that someone's reviewing. So, yeah, that's probably a few things that have changed over the course of the books is that I don't need that sort of pretend checkpoint anymore. So, yeah.
That's so interesting. I really like, and I'm taking my own notes here because I like how you've really clearly identified your own tendencies towards procrastination and what that looks like. And I think, you know, if anything, as you're going through each book, for me, they never seem to get any easier except for those things you can identify in your own process where you're like, ah, oh, I see what I'm doing here again.
Yeah.
I think they're the helpful bits.
Yeah, for sure. No, I'm pretty pragmatic. And, you know, I had a really tough time with my third book. I really thought it was in quite a good place. And then I got quite challenging editorial feedback. And that really was difficult for me. Just rewriting something that you think's pretty good is hard.
Yeah.
And I definitely didn't disagree with any of the feedback. I thought the feedback was amazing. But that was almost the hardest part, was that I didn't want to fight it. I just thought, how the hell am I going to actually do this? So it was like untangling this huge thing that I'd put together. And so I do just tend to get on with it. I don't really wallow very much. I'm not a wallower, which is very helpful, I think, in this particular profession. So I don't know what's going to happen with this book. I might rewrite it like 5 times between now and when it's a book. And that's what it is. I'll still have a book at the end, hopefully. So, yes.
That's really interesting because I think that sometimes people would tend to think that writers who are up to their third or fourth or fifth book, you know, that they're just kind of flowing through it and they're not copping a whole lot of flack from their editors, etc. When you were in that moment and it felt like a huge impossible tangle when you got that editorial feedback, how did you proceed?
Well, just with gritted teeth, really, because I kind of thought, well, what am I going to do? I can either have a tantrum and say I can't do it.
Yeah.
I can't really put it on Airtasker and get someone else to do it, so which I did think about. Great. I really, really thought about that. and I would have paid probably quite a lot of money as well. I was just frustrated for sort of 24 hours, but frustrated more with myself than anyone else, I think. And then I just started working through it. So, I mean, the good thing about writing is that it is just word by word. You're in control. You know, you can do it. It's just time. At the end of the day, you can do it. It's not an impossible mission. You don't need to be fit or specifically skilled in any particular way. You just need to sit there and do it. So I sat there and did it, I guess. And, you know, it's
like
definitely
you're my
a better
personal trainer today. Like, I'm sitting here with this enormous grin on my face. I'm like, yes, Sarah's going to get me going.
Well, I also think, I mean, when I work in advertising and I'm not in the creative department, but I am often the person that has to deliver feedback to the creative teams. And sometimes it's fair feedback, sometimes it's political, sometimes it's just completely wrong, but it's what needs to be done for whatever reason. And so I guess I've witnessed a lot of projects get completely derailed or pivot, having to pivot, and often they do end up being really strong ideas or better than original thought. So I guess I'm pragmatic in the sense that I know that sometimes feedback's just what needs to happen to get to a good result, and people see things that you don't see. I'm trying to apply some of that editorial feedback to this book, so that, you know, I'm obviously learning from past rabbit holes and past tendencies and things like that. But I think sometimes the way you write, just the way you write, and you do need someone external to kind of come in and point things out to you that you know, for whatever reason, just block when you're in that part of the process. And that's okay. It's still yours. You just have to work with what makes sense to you. And of course, if I ever get editorial feedback that doesn't make sense, I do, you know, push back and question it and explain why. But I do find more often than not, it's just someone being able to have that bird's eye view that, you know, when you've been working on something for such a long time, you get a bit, you sort of, it's hard to see. It's a bit cloudy, I think, sometimes.
It certainly is.
Yeah.
Sarah, I want to ask a little bit about your advertising comms background. Do you feel like that's helped or hindered in terms of that outward facing author self promotion, et cetera?
I'm sure it's helped in the sense that I feel relatively comfortable public speaking. I would say that the writing public speaking has still been a bit more challenging than a lot of the stuff I've ever done in advertising, just because it's very solo. But normally in advertising, it's, you know, in a team environment where we might be doing a pitch, but there's six of us together and we're presenting a section each of a presentation or something. Whereas, you know, in a book kind of context, you tend to be either on a panel or you're doing a reading, or it's all about you. So it's still been a little bit of a learning curve, I think, for me. But no, I'm pretty comfortable in kind of presenting, and I'm comfortable in getting feedback. I think that's been a huge help.
Yeah,
I'm pretty comfortable in knowing that, yeah, things change and that's okay. Everyone's going to have a point of view on sort of the way a piece of art will come together, and I come from that world, so that's fine. So I think overall it's helped, and I think the deadline thing has helped. I mean, I'm a big believer in, like, people can do more than they think they can, and often people say no to something sort of as a first response, but ultimately it can be done if everyone just puts their mind to it. And I guess that's sort of how I feel about, you know, feedback particularly. So I think the deadline and the pace at which I work has probably helped quite a lot.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I still wish I was someone who could be a bit more structured the first time around. I think that would save me an awful lot of time. But that's okay. I think that's just the way that I work, and that's fine too. You know, there's no point kind of trying to corral yourself into a format that's just never going to work for you.
Yeah. You're talking about the that kind of team environment of your workplace. Who's in your kind of writing team? Like, do you have a writer's group? Do you have a kind of online writing gang? Do you have a mentor? Who makes up that group for you?
Well, I think, again, that's probably changed a little bit. I don't have as much time this year because my work is very full-time, and it's quite, it's a demanding full-time job. But when I was working in a previous job for the last 2 years, which was a little bit more flexible, I probably spent a little bit more time engaged in the writing world. So I have a couple of friends that you know, I do catch up with pretty regularly or see at book events. And there's a group that I was meeting with for dinner, a whole bunch of other female writers. That was really nice, just hearing all of their experiences. And we'd sort of have dinner once every couple of months. And, just some individual people that I've met along the way, which is lovely. And then my publisher, Jane has a whole bunch of Melbourne-based authors, and she tries to organise a kind of a Christmas thing once a year for us all to catch up, and I've met lots of people that way. So, yeah, it was sort of fairly varied, but it was really – it's always really refreshing spending time with someone else who understands the weird battle that you have with a Microsoft Word document, you know. It's really strange. And
It is.
You know, family and friends are great, and they'll always ask how things are going, and that's really lovely. But they don't understand, and I mean, I'm not saying that it's a victim or anything. We're not victims, but it is strange. And I think when someone says, "Oh, how's the book coming along?" it's a really hard question to answer, because you kind of feel like saying, "Oh, go away." Like, it's not. I can't even answer that question. There's so many parts of that question that can be answered in a different way. And I think if people don't write themselves, they tend to just ask about words, and so they think that when the words are there, that's it. And so and because for me especially, that is definitely not the case. They'll kind of go, "Oh, you're finished," and I'm like, "No." Nah. So it's definitely nice having a little community that you can tap into. I think that's quite important.
How do you manage, social media? Are you on Twitter off it? Do you doing lots of book stuff for Instagram? Do you just stay away from the whole thing? Do you only do it in book promo time? How do you manage?
It's pretty ad hoc, I think.
Yeah.
I really like all of the social media platforms. I think they're all fun and have served different purposes. When something is going on in the world, I love Twitter. I think it's a great place to be when there's sort of a need for people to be congregated in one sort of place and sharing opinions. And I think it's great for humour and politics and a combination of the two. And I think that's I really find myself drawn there when there's something going on, like an event in the world that's happening.
As do I.
Yeah, whereas when there's not, I don't tend to find it to be somewhere where I kind of go on a daily basis. And then Instagram, it's for me, it's a weird mix because it's people I know, and then it's also some book kind of Bookstagram blogger people, which I really enjoy as well. So it's, I don't have two accounts. I have been told I should. I can't be bothered. And I just like that it's a bit of everything. So it's books, kids, drinks, whatever. I don't really, it's just me. It just, So obviously if there's a book that's being promoted, it'll be a bit more around that, I suppose. And then if not, then a bit more about wine, I suppose.
Excellent. As all things should be.
Yeah, I think so.
Before I let you go, Sarah, you've given me already, like, honestly, this thing down next to me, I've got all of these things written down. What is your advice for debut authors or authors who are about to go into this weird, strange business that we are in?
Well, I mean, I would prepare to be a bit frustrated because it's pretty strange and a lot of it is luck. I'm a big believer that, I mean, I think you have to put yourself in the way of luck. So luck will never get you anywhere on its own. You have to do a lot of work, but I do think that you can be strategic about putting yourself in the way of good luck. So, you know, get the thing written, make sure it's in a pretty good shape. Get it in front of people, do your research, follow their instructions, all of those types of basic things. But at the end of the day, you've got to write the book. And that doesn't matter if you're a debut author or if you've written 25 books and you're writing your 26th, you just have to write the book. So whatever way you can get a book written, you just have to do that. And I do think you've got to be a bit careful that you don't spend all your time trying to work out how you're going to write the book. You just have to write the book. And that's a big procrastination rabbit hole. I think people can tumble down. So, yeah, you've just got to find some time, however that might exist in your 24 hours, and start getting the words into a file, really.
So good. Honestly, I feel like I could finish the book today now, like you've given me a personal training session. Sarah, can I ask you, your favourite novel by a debut author, please?
Well, so I could probably name hundreds. I did really, really love The Nancys by Rob McDonald. I just thought it was so original and different and refreshing and cute but not naff, you know, just a really fun but quite deep book. So how he managed to squeeze that genre into all of those different sort of things I thought was pretty masterful. And I just, yeah, I really enjoyed that. I thought it was just a really fun, nice book to read.
Excellent recommendation. Sarah, this has been a dream for my first doing. I can't see you. You are an absolute dream. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. No, it was really nice to chat to you as well.
Okay. So, Sarah Bailey, your first time quick five. I now have to say you're allowed to pass on any question because Catherine and I disagree about asking how many books you've sold. So here we go.
Sure.
For your first time, were you agented or unagented?
Agented.
Did you get an advance or no advance?
An advance.
Were overseas territories sold?
Yes.
And whereabouts? Languages have you seen your name?
Yeah, The Dark Lake has been sold in the US and Canada, in the UK, Italy, Turkey, Poland, Germany, and China, I think.
Oh, that's a great list. I love that. Have you got all the copies in one bookshelf, one special bookshelf?
I've got a bookshelf full of my books, which does sound really wanky, but yes, there's quite a lot of copies. but most of them are the US ones. But yeah, I've got a couple of the foreign language ones, which do look very nice.
Excellent. Did you get festival invites?
Yes, I think I got like one or two festival invites in that first year, which was, yeah, it was really fun.
And do you know how many copies have sold of The Dark Lake?
I think in Australia it might be about 30,000.
Amazing.
And then I don't know about internationally. It's a bit sketchier. I've been told I'll never get the numbers from China. So there you go. mystery.
Information that will not reveal. Sarah, thank you.
You're welcome.
You can find the show notes for this episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. If you're feeling so inclined, we would love for you to leave us a review wherever you listen. This helps other people find us.
Get in touch with us via the contact page on our website or connect with the entire First Time gang on Twitter or Instagram at The First Time Pod. And don't forget, you can support us via Patreon. Go to patreon.com/thefirsttimepodcast. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We recorded this episode at Kathleen Syme Library on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. The First Time Podcast is produced by Phoebe 80 and supported by Writers Victoria, the ACT Writers Centre, and our wonderful patrons.